It was an abstraction, an idea, nothing more. The blonde boy, when he saw Surratt approach, sprang from the Mandarin crate box on which he was seated.
"What do you want?"
he said, approaching. "I'm looking for Leonard," Surratt replied.
"Got a letter for him." "This ain't your place. Leave!"
The boy was pale, as though he'd spent no time under the southern sun. A pink streak ran from the left side of his neck down to near his belly button. Surratt could not tell whether it was a rash or some natural imperfection or the remains of burned skin. He was 3 or 4 inches shorter than she was, and at least 30 pounds lighter, his hip bones like the blades of cleavers.
"I'll leave after I give this to Leonard,"
Surratt said, holding out the letter.
"You deaf?"
the boy replied.
"I said get out, now!"
He came to push her, his hands landing in the space between her shoulders and her breasts. It was then that something deep within her snapped. She felt a searing inflammation, a fire in the cavities behind her eyes. With a guttural roar, she leaped for the boy, palms turned to vices around his throat. He tumbled back onto the ground, and she jumped on him, his arms pinned beneath the thick planks of her shins. Her first punch landed square. The boy's nose cracked. Surratt threw another, and another, until her limbs felt as though they were not her own. With each punch, she exhaled, and the exhales soon turned to screams. In the wide, blood-splattered eyes of the wiry Carolina boy, she caught, for an instant, her own rabid reflection. A moment later, she was lifted, her limbs still moving, but her body caught by a pair of handless arms. She was set down on the dirt by a man nearly 7 feet tall and wide enough to momentarily eclipse her view of the retreating boy. She tried to scramble around the man's legs, but he held her firm, his stumps hard against her shoulders.
"Enough,"
the man said.
"Stay."
Surratt tried to break from the man's hold, but could not. She turned to see his face. It was ruined, the lips gone, and in their place, thin slivers of brown-crusted skin, the cheeks wrinkled and charred. She saw the cavernous aperture where his right eye once was, and she was hypnotized by it.
"What's this about?"
the man said. Surratt held out the envelope.
"I have to give this to Leonard,"
she said. The man took the envelope, pinned it between his wrists.
"You've done it,"
he said.
"All right?"
"All right."
She saw the boy standing behind the man, blood still running from his shifted nose. There was a wild fear in his eyes, but it was not the girl he was looking at. It was the man.
"You tell Gaines something for me,"
Leonard told Surratt.
"Tell him there's 2 families that got no one to provide for them no more."
He held up the envelope.
"And this alone don't make that right."
"Fine,"
Surratt said. She turned to leave.
"Hold on,"
Leonard said. He turned to the boy.
"Did I raise a coward?"
he asked.
"No, sir,"
the boy replied, his voice hushed and mechanical, his eyes lowered.
"Sure looks like it right now. Apologize."
The boy stepped forward.
"I'm sorry,"
he said. Surratt said nothing.
"It's all right,"
Leonard said.
"You don't have to accept it. He just has to say it."
When she returned to the administrative buildings, Surratt found Albert Gaines seated on a bench by the central office. He was reading an old paper book whose cover bore the curled scribblings of a language Surratt recognized but did not understand. There was no illustration on the cover, only a geometric pattern in swooping, saber-curved lines. The writing resembled a more elaborate version of the same script Surratt had seen 1,000 times before on the sides of the food and water containers, the aid packages, and the Red Crescent vans. The language of foreigners.
"Leonard says to tell you this don't make up for the other 2 families who got nobody to provide for them,"
Surratt said. Gaines looked up from his book and smiled.
"Leonard has earned his fictitious chivalry, I suppose."
He pulled a bill from his wallet and held it out to Surratt.
As we agreed, he said.
Surratt stared at the money. It was a Northern 20, a genuine greenback stamped with the portrait of some long-dead president. The bill's holograms were of an ancient granite-columned mausoleum, its contours shimmering in the light.
Go on, take it, Gaines said. I know, it's blue money, right? Well, remember this. There's no sin in using what's theirs against them.
As she reached for the bill, Gaines held her wrist. She saw he was looking at the reddened, blood-marked knuckles.
Well, I assume it wasn't Leonard, he said. His boy?
He pushed me, Surratt replied. Gaines removed from his breast pocket a gray silk handkerchief and wiped the blood from Surratt's knuckles.
Good girl, he said.
He released her wrist. Up close, Surratt could better see the pockmarks in his face. They put more years on him. And yet, he did not look as aged nor as tired as the men who lived in the camp. There was a vibrancy about him, a burning bulb of confidence lighting his ashen blue eyes. He sat different, the spine stiff and tall. He had about him a kind of calmness that reminded her of her father. Thanks, she said, pocketing the money. I'll see you around, I guess. She turned to leave.
Surratt, Gaines said. Would you like to join me for a late dinner?
You got a tent here? Surratt asked. I thought you were one of those free Southerners here from Atlanta.
I do not, and I am not, Gaines said. But I do keep an office here, and I suspect you'll find the few provisions I keep there, meager as they are, to be a welcome respite from the sludge they feed you in this place. Come.
Surratt followed him to the back of the main administrative building. He unlocked a side door. Since the day she arrived at the camp, she'd only set foot in the supervisor's offices a handful of times. It was a dim, unremarkable building, the walls painted the sickly pinkish ivory of fingernails. They descended a staircase she'd never seen before, and passed a metal door to a small basement. Here, the single hallway was narrow, and the concrete unpainted. At the end of the hallway was a door. Gaines unlocked it, and held it open. Surratt stepped inside. The room smelled of mahogany and citrus. Behind her, Gaines flicked the light switch.
Make yourself at home, he said. It's always a pleasure to receive visitors.
It was a low-walled room, narrow but long, with a couple of small windows that were level with the ground outside. To her left, Surratt saw a desk of thick chocolate mahogany, its legs like the bottom halves of hourglasses. On the desk was a neat stack of manila envelopes and an old teardrop-tipped fountain pen from a previous century. Next to those lay a letter opener with a golden blade. On the wall adjacent to the desk, there were a series of maps, one Surratt recognized as the Mag. Another seemed to detail the Tennessee line, where so much of the worst fighting took place. The third and fourth maps were alien, covered in strange circular doodles and large painted swaths of red and blue and brown. The two maps furthest down the wall, Surratt had seen before, in a book, long ago. They were maps of the whole world, one from 100 years ago, one from today.
Do you know where you are?
Gaines asked, standing behind her. She pointed vaguely at the square of land on the left side of the map.
That's Georgia, Gaines said. But that's very close.
He took her hand in his and moved it a few inches northwest.
And do you know the places where the aid ships come from? The places that send us all those blankets and all the food that ends up in the cafeteria?
Surratt stared at the map. Gaines pointed first to a big mass of land on the right side of the map.
Some of it comes from China.
Then his finger moved to the center, to a country whose sprawling borders cover the northern third of one continent and the rectangular peninsula to the east.
And some of it comes from the Buazizi Empire.
What's an empire? Surratt asked.
An empire is when many small countries become part of one big country, willingly or otherwise, Gaines said.
An empire is what we used to be.
Surratt looked over at the old map, the one from 100 years earlier. The area Gaines had pointed to was, in this map, a mess of doodled borders, some describing countries so small their printed names overlapped. On the new map, the entire mass simply bore one word, Bouazizi.
Back when I was your age, the people in these countries had a revolution, Gaines said. It failed. Then they had another one. And another.
And on the fifth try, they finally won. He pointed to a stretch of blue that marked the boundary between the Bouazizi Empire's northern edge and the European continent.
If you ever stand anywhere on this shore, say in New Algiers, you'll see fleets of ragged little boats headed southward from the European shore, he said. Boats full of migrants from the old Union countries, looking for better lives. That's what an empire is, he said. An orchestrator of gravity. A sun around which all weaker things spin.
As Surratt continued to study the map, Gaines retrieved something from a small refrigerator nearby. A moment later, she was interrupted from her thoughts by the smell of toast.
Have you ever tasted honey? Gaines asked.
Yeah, Surratt replied. They gave it to us every few months with the rations. It's fine, I guess.
That's not honey. That's mush, grown by scientists in a lab in Pearl River.
Gaines set the toast on a plate and the plate on the table. Surratt watched him unseal a small glass jar in which sat two hexagon-gridded sheets sunk in a caramel-colored liquid. He spooned some of the honey on the toast.
This comes from something living, he said. What you get from the living, you can never truly copy. You can never fake. Taste it.
Surratt sat at the table and took a bite. Instantly, the sweetness set off fireworks on her tongue. She moved the honey against the roof of her mouth and found the quieter undercurrents beneath the sugar. A slight hint of coffee, an earthiness, something faintly metallic and damp. Somewhere in the caverns of her mind awoke memories of the place where she was born, the mud banks, the hot tin box, the mouth of the Mississippi. Like a stranger to herself, she was surprised to discover she'd started softly crying.
We forget sometimes, Gaines said, that there are still beautiful things.
He asked her where she was from.
I was born in St. James, Louisiana,
Surratt said.
I have always loved Louisiana,
Gaines replied. He pointed at the old map on the wall.
Do you want to know what your home state once looked like?
Surratt nodded. She had seen it before, seen the tentacles of marsh and swamp and the boot-shaped expanse of land they'd once formed. But she wanted him to show her. She followed him to the map. He pointed to the place where Louisiana's shattered hourglass figure brushed against the western edge of Mississippi.
You see here, where the river meets the Gulf? That used to be land. Beautiful land. And here, near where the eastern shore is now, there used to be the loveliest city in all of America.
The girl observed the map. On the newer one, on the wall beside it, the place where the man pointed, was a uniform blue.
Where were you born?
She asked him.
I was born in a place called Rome,
Gaines said.
Where's that?
Well, the famous one was in a place called Italy, but the one I came from is in New York.
Surratt watched the man's eyes for signs of a lie, but there were none. She realized then that, save for the dwindling number of journalists who showed up at the camp every now and then and who always made great effort to appear geographically neutral, she'd never met a northerner before.
You're a blue,
she said.
I didn't say that,
he replied. You asked me where I was born, and I told you. Had you asked me where I call home, I would have told you something different.
What are you, then?
She asked.
Gaines sat at the table. Well, he said. When I was young, I was a soldier. This was back when there was no red and no blue, just the one military of the United States of America. Then, when I was through being a soldier, I studied to become a doctor. And for a while, I worked as a plastic surgeon. Do you know what plastic surgery is?
You made people look pretty.
Gaines laughed. I suppose I did, in a way. I spent most of my time helping people who had been very badly burned. I specialized in repairing damaged skin.
You still do that now?
I still practice medicine, you could say. I volunteer at the field hospitals along the Tennessee line. I worked for a time near your old home in Louisiana, out by the oil fields.
You help rebels.
I help Southerners.
It doesn't matter to me, Surratt said. My brother's just about set to join the Virginia Cavaliers. He thinks he's keeping it a big secret, but I know all about it.
Then for his safety, you shouldn't go around telling everyone, should you?
I didn't tell everyone. I told you.
Gaines smiled. You know, before I practiced medicine, I wanted to become a mathematician. I was obsessed with very large numbers and the way you can use them to tell secrets. But my father was a doctor, and he wanted me to study medicine. He used to say the only truly stable profession is blood work, the work of the surgeon, the soldier, the butcher. He said all industries rise and fall, but as long as there is even a single man still alive, there will always be use for blood work. And I suppose he was right.
So what are you doing in patients, then?
Asked Surratt.
I've seen the man they bring here once a week to hand out pills. You ain't the camp doctor.
No, I don't come here to hand out pills. What I come here to do, what you could say these days is my chief occupation, is something I don't talk about with most people. But since I've taken a liking to you, Surratt, and since you were so kind to make that delivery on my behalf, and since you've shared the secret of your brother's affiliation with me, I think it's only fair that I, in turn, share a secret with you. Isn't that right?
That's right,
Surratt said instinctively. What I do is travel around the southern state, sometimes to camps like this, or towns along the border where the blues and their birds have caused terrible carnage, and I look for special people.
Special how?
Asked Surratt. Well, courageous, I suppose, said Gaines. But courage isn't enough. How do I say it? Let me ask you something. Do you ever see people in this camp who've been hurt by the Northerners, who've lost their limbs or their sight or a family member?
Hell, most people here are like that, said Surratt.
That's right. And doesn't it make you angry to know that the ones who did that to your people got away with it?
I guess.
And don't you wish you could do something about it?
Surratt paused, silent.
I suspect right now you're thinking, what can I do? I'm stuck here in this camp that may as well be a prison. What can I do against a whole army full of grown men with guns? Maybe there's nothing I can do. Nothing at all.
I didn't say that, Surratt replied.
Gaines laughed. Of course you didn't. Of course you didn't. And that's my first inkling, Surratt, that maybe you're one of the special ones. So let me tell you what it is I do. I seek out special people, people who, if given the chance and the necessary tools, would stand up and face the enemy on behalf of those who can't. I seek out people who would do this even if they knew for certain that it would cost them dearly, maybe even cost them their lives. And then I do everything in my power to give them the tools, to give them their chance. Surratt waited for him to say more. But he sat quietly, watching her. She struggled to think of a reply, some means of convincing him she understood exactly what he had said, even though she did not. Even though she was mystified by almost all of it. The silence grew leaden around her. She blushed.
Ah, never mind all that, Gaines said suddenly.
We'll have plenty of time for that sort of talk later. For now, what say you we listen to some music?
All right, Surratt said. Gaines stood and walked to a set of bookshelves on the other side of the room. The shelves were full of old paper books. Some were impossibly thick, others bound in leather and inscribed with delicate golden script. While his back was turned, Surratt ate another spoonful of honey. At the bottom of the middle shelf, there was a small, flat contraption Surratt had never seen before, and two small speakers connected to it. Gaines ran his finger along a row of thin plastic cases lining one of the shelves. He pulled one case out and opened it. Inside was a round disc whose underside turned the light to rainbows. He pushed a button on the contraption, and its top sprang open. He set the disc inside, closed the lid, and pushed a button. A faint whirring sound followed.
Does your family still have many old things?
Yes, Surratt.
Things from before the war?
Not really, Surratt said. We used to have a few of my grandparents' things back home, photos and a wristwatch and a couple of letters, but we left most of them behind when we came here.
That's a shame, isn't it? The first thing they try to take from you is your history.
A soft, stringed lament silenced their conversation. The room filled with music. At its heart was an instrument Surratt had only heard once or twice before, low, earthen strings, dampened as though filtered through the bones of deathbed oaks. "This is my grandmother's favorite song," Gaines said. "Listen." A woman's voice emerged from behind the waning strings. It was a voice unlike anything Surratt had ever heard before, full and deep and ciphered in a language she did not understand.
"Son qual stanco pellegrino," Gaines said.
The words meant nothing to Surratt, but their phonetic echoes clung to the walls of her mind. She listened, enchanted. And afterward, when Gaines said he would like her and him to become friends, and that he would like to teach her about music and art and many other things from the vast and varied world beyond the gates of patience, she nodded without thinking. Gaines smiled.
"I think you'll find a place for yourself in this world, Surratt," he said. "I think you'll make a place for yourself in this world."
Excerpted from A Northern Soldier's Education in War and Peace, the memoirs of General Joseph Weiland, Jr.
I was only 29 years old when President Daniel Key was assassinated. At the time, I was a compensation claims officer in Columbus, working in a small department within the War Office. The War of Southern Secession had only just begun. Not coincidentally, the earliest days of the war were also some of the most prolific lawmaking and nation-building years in American history, rivaling only the years during which the Capitol was relocated inland from storm-ravaged Washington, D.C. It was during those early wartime years when the federal government succeeded in passing the Clean Fission Act, restarted the Eastern and Western Seaboard decommissioning initiatives, laid down the first 1,000 miles of the Sun Belt transit system, and greatly expanded the overfill suburbs around Pittsburgh, Indianapolis, and Lexington. War is movement, my father likes to say. At the time, the department I worked at was located about 2 miles east of the executive building, where my father worked in an office down the hall from President Martin Henley's briefing room. He used to call me up from time to time, usually to discuss some compensation claim I had recently approved. I remember one such meeting early on in the war. On my way to see him that day, I passed the threat map in the lobby of the executive building. On that morning, a portion of the southern fortification was pulsing the black and red color that indicated an attack had taken place. By my count, it was the third such attack in 3 weeks. I learned later that it was another homicide bomb, aimed at the more vulnerable defenses of the Capitol's outer wire. No insurrectionist had ever managed to penetrate the blue square itself, but it is an unfortunate reality that there have been many cowardly attacks against the outer wire, attacks that have taken the lives of many brave guards. We lost 4 guards that day. When I reached my father's office, I saw that he had been reading my latest compensation decision regarding an Alabama claimant who alleged incidental property damage from an unoriented drone. I watched him skim the pages of my report, looking over the assessment of facts, the reasons for judgment, and the compensation amount. His face was, as always, unreadable. Serene. He asked if there had been any collaterals. I said there were none, but that the man had lost all his belongings and was forced to seek shelter in the camps near Atlanta, which were known to be poorly managed by the insurrectionist government. "I thought we had a policy on unoriented drone damage," my father said. "We do, but I made an exception in this case," I replied. "It's the second time his house has been hit." "Struck twice by lightning? So either he's a liar or he's got terrible luck. Seems like either one shouldn't be enough to prompt a violation of policy." I came to reply, but he'd foreseen my argument and preempted me. "The amount doesn't matter," he said. "Every compensation claim is a statement. When you compensate a UOD strike claim, you take responsibility for a crime committed by your enemy. It was the insurrectionists who destroyed the server farms. They're the reason we have no more control over the drones. Do you see them handing out compensation claims for UOD strikes?" I argued that the claimant's residence was in a strategically important area near the Tennessee line, and that by paying his claim, we could help shift the perception among some Southerners that the federal government was unsympathetic to the plight of those living under corrupt insurrectionist rule. My father smiled. "Tell me," he said, "do you have an opinion about whose cause is right in this war?" he asked. "Of course," I said. "And how much would I have to pay you to get you to change your mind?" Eventually, I came to accept my father's reasoning. I knew, despite how many soldiers he had lost in the war, he held no grudges against the people of the South. Let us not forget that it was his decision, made against the fierce objections of many federal politicians, to assign refugee Southern patriots to guard the Blue Zone's outer wire, a job they perform with supreme courage. Chapter 7. A faint evening rain fell over Camp Patience. Back in Surratt's childhood home, the rain used to make a sharp sound as it hit the shipping container's roof. But here in the camp, it was a whispered admonition, a soft shh against the tattered tents. Surratt listened. She lay in her cot, her mother and sister asleep nearby. Through the window flap, a soft line of silver moonlight illuminated her sleeping sister's face. Their mother once said they were two birds hatched from the same egg, the same bones and blood inside them. And although Surratt had read one of Gaines's books on genetics and now knew that wasn't entirely true, she still liked to believe it. Whenever she got to thinking about why Dana's skin was light and hers dark, or why Dana's hair fell straight and bright and hers, before she shaved it, was fuzzy, she told herself that these things didn't matter. What mattered was bones and blood. She watched Dana sleeping, her face cast in alabaster light. She did a thing she'd done since they were little children. She held her breath, manipulated it until it synchronized with her sister's, until their chests rose and fell in time. She lay still and breathed as her sister breathed, and listened to the whispering rain. At around 4 in the morning, Simon stumbled through the door. He tried to move quietly, but he was drunk, and in the dark he stubbed his foot against his bedside locker. At the sound of his muffled cursing, a light went on in the back of the tent. Martina got out of her bed, as did Surratt and Dana. "Go back to sleep, for Christ's sake," said Simon, struggling to get his boots off. "Where were you?" asked Martina. "You haven't been home in 4 days.
"The hell it matters where I was. There's a sign-in sheet I didn't know about."
Surratt could smell the reek of joyful on him, could see he was that aggravated kind of drunk where even your own skin feels itchy as wool. She'd seen a lot of men at Patience get that kind of drunk. Martina walked to the front of the tent. She reached for her son and grabbed the pendant she saw hanging around his neck. It was a bullet casing pierced near its top with an iron nail, the symbol of the Virginia Cavaliers. In the South, every rebel group had its own symbol, coiled snakes or Texas oil drills or words drawn in barbed wire. The Virginia Cavaliers had a bullet with a nail through it. Everyone already knew.
For months, Simon had been out with the rebels along the Tennessee line, sneaking in and out of patients through the inlets near the northeastern border. And for months, both he and his mother had simply pretended it wasn't so. But on this night, there was no use pretending.
"How can you go and do the one thing you promised me you wouldn't do?" Martina said, looking Simon over like he was someone else's son.
"Do I look like I blew myself up?"
Simon replied.
"I didn't do a damn thing."
"You've gone and joined them," she said. "Join the same ones who blew up that permit office in Baton Rouge, the ones who killed your father."
At the mention of his father, Simon's face crumpled. He snatched the necklace from his mother's hand.
"You killed him,"
he screamed.
"You killed him with all your nagging about going north, going north. He was happy where he was, happy in his home, but you pushed him to do it. It was you who killed him, nobody else."
She slapped him across the face, and at the sight and sound of it, Surratt and Dana were jolted. But Simon did not move.
"What kind of child says something so cruel to his own mother?" Martina said. "I'm not a child," Simon replied. "I'm a man."
His voice was louder than his mother and sisters had ever heard before, as though the louder he said it, the more true it became.
"I'm a man! I'm a man! I'm a man!"
He tore the front door open and stumbled back out of the tent, and when he was gone, his mother sat on his bed and wept. Instinctively, Surratt and Dana sat by her side to comfort her, and in that moment, Surratt had never hated anyone more than she hated her only brother. In the weeks and months to come, both mother and son would dismiss what happened that night. Both would say that it was just one of those fights every family has, that they didn't really mean what they said. But Surratt knew each had meant every word. Soon that old hardness set in, and Martina was herself again. That night, she stayed up well into the morning talking with her daughters. She told them about that day when Benjamin Chestnut went up to Baton Rouge and never came back. She told them about the night she went to see the rebel commander about refuge, and the night the falling bombs chased them from their home. Surratt woke around noon, drenched in sweat from the midday heat, to the sound of Marcus at the door.
"You been sleeping this whole time?"
he asked, handing her a juice cup he'd smuggled from the old cafeteria building.
"Long night.
What's up?"
"I was out by Chalk Hollow looking for turtle food for Sherilyn, and I saw a whole bunch of rebels out by that island across the lake,"
Marcus said.
"They had a ton of stuff with them, boxes and boxes."
"They're out earlier than normal," Surratt said. "Can't be coming into the camp in the daylight. People will see."
"That's right. I heard one of them say they'll come back for their stuff after sundown."
It took Surratt a moment before she realized what her friend meant.
"So you want to go see what they got in those boxes?"
Marcus smiled. They walked to the eastern edge of the camp. They passed Marcus's tent, where his father sat on a plastic garden chair, a sweat-soaked rag over his balding head. With a pair of binoculars, he was watching the blue soldiers who lay hidden among the trees beyond the northern fence. Every few minutes, he'd mark something down in an old notebook, like a bird watcher deep in observation. Marcus entered the tent and returned with a small Donald Duck backpack, into which he'd stuffed a couple of water bottles and apricot gel sandwiches. He walked briskly, a step ahead of Surratt. She was a foot taller than he was, and the manner in which he walked, almost hunched, his eyes focused on the ground, only exacerbated the difference in height between them. When he was with her, he was a little more confident, but otherwise he seemed perpetually hobbled by shyness and anxiety. Some of the boys in the camp had started a rumor that, because of his size, he was forced to wear hand-me-downs from some of the girls and patients. To Surratt, this kind of drive-by cruelty was a normal part of camp life, and even if it were true he wore younger kids' clothes, what did it matter? Who cared? But Marcus seemed especially distraught by it, so much so that she'd seen him walking around a few times dressed in jeans and shirts that were entirely too large for his frame, a decision that prompted a whole new round of ridicule from the boys. But when he was with her, he was himself. She enjoyed the feeling it gave her to know it, to be his protector, his confidant. But there was something else, a comfort he unwittingly afforded her. It was the comfort of his smallness.
The meekness and harmlessness of him allowed her to explore without fear her fluid feelings on attraction and companionship and boys, the hormonal gauntlet of adolescence. Other than him, she had almost no friends her own age. But she wondered if the thing he gave her wasn't friendship's only useful purpose, a testing site for new and unfamiliar emotions, free of hazard, free of judgment. When they reached Chalk Hollow, they climbed over the fallen trees and down to the bank. Marcus pointed to the small, uninhabited island north of Smith Branch, about a quarter mile ahead of them in the water. "You see it?" he asked. Surratt squinted. Barely visible beyond the shore was the edge of a raised tarp, although the things it covered were hidden. "They said they wouldn't be back till after sunset?" she asked. "Yeah," Marcus said. "I don't know how we get over there, though." Surratt shrugged. "We swim." Marcus's courage seemed suddenly to abandon him. With trepidation, he looked out at the water, thick and murky, its surface the color of the soil. "Well, how did you think we'd get out there?" asked Surratt. "I don't know," Marcus replied. "I thought we'd get a boat or something." Surratt laughed. "What boat you ever see around here didn't have a man with a gun on it?" She stripped down to her underwear and stepped onto the remains of a small dock whose planks teetered unevenly into the water. "Come on," she said. "It's not so far. But my bag will get wet. Give it here, then." Surratt held the bag high over her head like a sacrificial offering. She stepped off the edge of the plank and into the water. Marcus took off his clothes until he, too, was only in his underwear, and then he followed. The water was as warm as the children's bodies, and so thick with soil and mud that it hardly felt like water at all. With Surratt leading and Marcus struggling to follow, they shuffled along like paddling dogs. Marcus's arms flailed wildly as he swam, but Surratt appeared to move with little effort. The backpack held high above her head, her legs doing all the work beneath the surface. When they finally arrived at the island's shore, they collapsed on a small stretch of beach. Marcus lay as though crucified, breathing heavily. Surratt lay beside him, her legs burning. The island had no name. It was small and had never seen much use. Once it was covered end-to-end with thick foliage, but now only the detritus of trees remained, browning stalks of deadwood, waist-high weeds and ancient leaves, brittle as crackers. Near the middle of the island, some of the tree trunks were still thick and tall, but nearer the shoreline, they were short and sickly. The children walked inland, following footprints in the soil. The trail led them along a jut of land that curled around the island's western shore like a comma, partially hiding a small parcel of beach from the sightline of anyone standing on the other side of the water. There, they found the large blue tarp, held up with branches and planks of wood. The tarp covered about a half dozen wooden crates. Most of the crates were nailed shut, but one sat on the ground with its lid slightly askew. The children approached carefully, listening for the sound of nearing boats. Surratt eased the crate's lid aside and peered at its contents. Marcus stood behind her, his attention split between the crate and the path leading inland. "What's in it?" he asked. Surratt picked up one of the metal discs stacked inside the crate. It looked familiar, but she couldn't quite place where she'd seen it before. It was heavy and circular, like a thick dinner plate, colored the same shade of brown as the land on which they stood. Its edge was lined with equidistant markers, and in its center there was something that looked like a fat black button. "I don't know," Surratt said. "Maybe there's something inside," Marcus replied. "Can you open it?" Suddenly, Surratt remembered watching the hopeless red grunts with their metal detectors, clearing the earth near the camp's northern fence. "It's a bomb," she said.
"What?"
"It's a bomb. They bury them under the ground, and when someone steps on them, they blow up." She could feel Marcus freeze behind her. "Walk away," she said. "Go on down that path over there. I'll be there in a second."
"I'm not just going to leave you with a bomb in your hand," Marcus said. "Just go, for God's sake. What's the point in both of us getting killed? Better that than you getting killed and me having to explain what happened. I ain't leaving.
With Marcus peering from around her shoulder and her heart pounding, she carefully set the landmine back in the crate. A few inches from the bottom of the crate, it slipped out of her hand and dropped. Surratt watched it, waiting for the inevitable explosion. And then, in an instant, she turned around, grabbed her friend by the hand, and sprinted toward the island's interior. They ran blind and mute through the thicket for 5 minutes without pause, until their exhaustion and the dawning realization that there had been no explosion brought them to rest.
What?
Said Marcus, gasping. But he couldn't form an end to the question, and finally, he just said,
What the hell? What the hell?
Surratt couldn't help but laugh, and quickly they were both in hysterics over their brush with death. Since their arrival, they'd been careful not to make too much noise, but now they cackled. They found themselves near the middle of the island, where the tree cover was thickest and the ground cool under the shade of the branches. About 20 feet up one of the tallest trees, Surratt saw a wooden observation platform, a lookout of sorts. Without a second thought, she started to climb the thick hemp rope that dangled from the tower.
What's up there?
Marcus asked.
Don't know, but I bet you can see the whole camp,
Surratt replied.
Bet you can even see the blues.
She climbed to the platform, and Marcus followed. Their view was obstructed a little by some of the nearby trees, but otherwise they were above most of the canopy. The world, blue to the north, red to the south, spread out before them. They unzipped the backpack and ate their sandwiches and watched the vast horizon. In the distance to the north, Surratt saw more acreage of browning forest land and a few dilapidated marinas and even the skeleton of a creekside condominium near where the Tennessee River flowed. From Albert Gaines's many maps, she had learned that there were natural borders and political borders. To the north, the land looked the same, but she knew there existed some invisible fissure in the earth where her people's country ended and the enemies began. They sat silent for a while, letting the sugar from the apricot gel slowly revive them.
You mad at me?
Marcus asked.
Why would you think that?
Surratt replied.
I haven't seen you lately. Came by your tent a few times, but you weren't there.
Been busy, I guess.
Doing what?
Learning.
Got a new teacher. Comes by a few times a week.
I thought you said they don't teach you anything worth knowing in patience.
They don't,
Surratt said.
But he ain't one of them useless teachers the Red Crescent folks bring in. He's teaching me all kinds of stuff they won't. Stuff they're too scared to teach.
Like what?
Marcus asked. Surratt pointed northward.
Like about them? About all the things they've done to us over the years? All the times they've put what's good for them ahead of what's good for us? You can go to school a million years down here, and they won't have the guts to tell you a single thing about Northerners. But now I'm learning what they're really like.
Marcus observed the land of the North with indifference.
My dad told me the other day that my grandfather was a Northerner, he said.
Like, he fought for them?
Asked Surratt. Marcus shook his head.
Nah, just worked up there, on the oil trains up in some place called Williston. Died in that big explosion in 69. My dad said the North didn't care about Prohibition too much before that. Said if the same thing happened in Texas, they wouldn't have done anything about it, even if it had killed 1,000. He said the thing about Northerners is, when it's good, it's their good alone. But when it's bad, it's everybody's bad to share.
If your dad hates them so much, how come he's always talking about sneaking out of here and going up to join them?
Surratt asked.
Just because he wants to go there don't mean he likes them, Marcus said.
Just means it's safe. If you had a chance to go where it's safe, wouldn't you?
Surratt thought about the question. It seemed sensible to crave safety, to crave shelter from the bombs and the birds and the daily depravity of war. But somewhere deep in her mind, an idea had begun to fester. Perhaps the longing for safety was itself just another kind of violence. A violence of cowardice, silence, submission. What was safety anyway, but the sound of a bomb falling on someone else's home?
I don't know, she said.
The sun began to set over the far side of Camp Patience. Surratt and Marcus descended from the lookout and walked back along the path to the edge of the island. Their underwear had dried on their bodies, but it felt good to slip into the water once again. With nothing inside the bag, there was no point in holding it above the water. Surratt slipped it on her back. Her hands free, she swam with ease, gliding. She'd learned recently that solid land was not the natural skin of the world, only a kind of parasitic condition that surfaced and receded in million-year cycles. The natural skin of the world was water, and all water on Earth was connected. In this way, she was able to make believe she was swimming not in some offshoot of the Tennessee River, but in that muddy place by the banks of the Mississippi. For a brief moment, she was home. After night fell, she ate dinner alone in her tent, and then she went to see Gaines. They'd settled into a thrice-weekly ritual. Every night he visited the camp, she would come to see him in his office. Sometimes he'd give her errands to run, envelopes stuffed with cash to hand out in the South Carolina slice. Eventually, the Carolinians got used to the sight of the tall, bald-headed girl crossing into their neighborhood. In time, the boys in South Carolina gave her the nickname Payday. But although any time she walked through the hermit sector, she had on her person more money than most of Camp Patience's refugees would see in a lifetime, not once did she worry about theft or harassment. They all knew who she worked for. After she ran the errands, she would return to Gaines's office and listen to him teach. Every night was different. Sometimes they discussed the natural world, a textbook spread open on the table before them full of pictures of all the plants and animals that didn't survive the planet's warming. Most often, they talked about the way things used to be. He fed her the old mythology of her people, the south of Spanish moss and palmetto fronds, of magnolia trees dressed up in leaves of history and history's stepsister, Apocrypha, of unmatched generosity and jubilant excess, of whole pigs smoked whole days and of peaches and pecans and key lime pie. She gorged on it all, delighted not only that such a world existed, but that she held to it some ancestral claim. How much of it was real, and how much pleasant fantasy, didn't matter. She believed every word. He said that her country once occupied the most fertile land in all of the world, mother of sugar, and mother of cotton, and mother of corn. He taught her about the first time the North had torn her country to shreds. He said people think of that war now the way they think about most wars. Just a bunch of young men killing young men on the orders of old men. But he said it was women who were left to clean it all up in the end. Women who rebuilt the scorched southern country and nursed what was left of those young men. He said there were even some women who fought and killed, disguised themselves in the clothing of men if they had to. Women who defied. Sometimes he gave her what he called lyrics. A script of sorts, relating to something they discussed that day. Then she'd go home and read it over, until she learned her part of the conversation. And the next time he returned to the camp, they'd talk through it, as naturally as though they'd had the same conversation 1,000 times.
What is the first anesthetic?
Wealth.
And if I take your wealth?
Necessities.
And if I demolish your home, burn your fields?
Acknowledgement.
And if I make it taboo to sympathize with your plight?
Family.
And if I kill your family?
God.
And God?
Hasn't said a word in 2,000 years.
Good girl.
Sometimes the meaning of the lyrics escaped her, but she committed them to memory anyway. She was certain one day they would suddenly reveal their meaning. One day, there might come reason to sing, and sing, she would. Surratt stood by the side of the administrative building, waiting for Gaines to arrive. He was the only man she had ever known who could enter and leave Patience whenever he pleased. No refugee was ever afforded such privilege, and even the camp's administrators and guards were forced to sign in and out every time they ventured into the red. But Gaines floated past the gates at any hour of the day or night, carefree, and without hassle. As though the gates marked not some severe wartime perimeter, but the entrance to his own summer home.
Once, she had been passing near Patience's front gate when Gaines arrived. She watched the young soldiers at the gate smile and shake his hand, inquiring about his health and the health of his family. He, in turn, asked them about their families, about their wives and parents and children, and whether they were comfortable in their apartments in Atlanta. Then the soldiers, in a sheepish way, made it clear that times were hard for them and their families, that the free southern state was late again in paying their wages, but that, anyway, what was the use in complaining? She watched as Gaines discreetly passed each of the soldiers a small envelope. The soldiers, even as they protested that they couldn't possibly accept such kindness, quickly snapped the envelopes from his hand. In that moment, Surratt saw the only sincere expressions of gratitude she had ever witnessed on the soldiers' faces. Watching the interaction, she needed no one to explain to her that, between the flag sewn on their uniforms and the money in Gaines's envelopes, there was no question where the young soldier's loyalty lay. It seemed perfectly reasonable, then, that Gaines should come and go through Patience whenever he pleased. A little after 11 o'clock, she saw him walking up the path from the southern gate. Every time they met, he had come alone, but on this night, he was joined by another man, a man she had never seen before.
"Surratt, I want to introduce you to a close friend of mine," said Gaines. "I've known him for a long time, since we were both not much older than you are now."
The man standing next to Gaines extended his hand. Surratt shook it. He appeared about the same age as Gaines, but his skin, the same caramel shade as Surratt's father, was smooth and almost entirely free of wrinkles.
"It's a pleasure to meet you, Surratt," the man said.
"Albert has told me a lot of very nice things about you.
My name is Joe."
There was an exotic quality to his accent, the phonemes leaden, berthed a little lower down in the throat. She recognized quickly that he was a foreigner. Gaines led Surratt and Joe into the administrative building and down the stairs to his office. Like Gaines, Joe appeared out of place in his neatly tailored suit and green silk tie. And like Gaines, he seemed to take pleasure in the rigidity of his posture, his shoulders level and proud, his spine a ruler. Inside, Surratt and Joe sat at the table while Gaines made coffee. He turned on the stereo and played the old classical song he liked, the one he called the Song of the Weary Pilgrim. For Surratt, he slathered honey on warm toast. She felt self-conscious in front of her unfamiliar companion and ate slower than usual. But he simply smiled and observed her as though he'd known her since birth.
"Albert tells me you are originally from Louisiana," Joe said. "Is that correct?"
"Yeah," Surratt said. "That's right."
"It's a very beautiful part of the world. I went there some years ago. Very proud people there. Very proud."
"And how about you?" Surratt said. "Where are you from?"
Joe seemed taken aback by the question, but quickly he regained his calm demeanor. He smiled at Gaines, then he pointed at one of the maps on the wall.
"I am from the Buazizi Empire. Do you know very much about the Buazizi Empire?"
Surratt shook her head.
"Just what Albert said, that it used to be a bunch of different countries and now it's one."
"That's correct," said Joe.
"It used to be that all those different countries were ruled by kings and generals who treated a few people very well and a lot of people very badly. So we had a revolution. And finally, we forced out the kings and forced out the generals and formed a republic, a democracy."
Even more so than Keynes, Joe projected an air of serenity when he spoke. He was bald, but for silver wings above the ears, clean-shaved, but for a thick mustache that perfectly described his upper lip. Surratt tried to pinpoint what it was about him that imbued him with such calmness, and finally she decided it must be because he was a visitor, an interloper, removed from the immediate consequences of the war raging all around him.
"So, what are you doing all the way out here?" she asked. "If you're from over there."
Joe nodded.
"That's a very good question. I am here because my country supports those who fight for freedom, wherever they are in the world. And that's what your people are doing, isn't it, Surratt?"
fighting for freedom?
Yes, sir.
Gaines rose from the table and walked to the bookshelves. He retrieved a book, one volume in a hardbound, green-covered collection. The writing on the spine and the cover was intricate and indecipherable to Surratt. The letters all conjoined, their peaks and loops like the roadmap of a hallucinated city. But Joe seemed to recognize the book.
My God,
Joe said.
You kept them? All these years?
Of course, Gaines replied. It's one hell of a gift.
He turned to Surratt.
When we were young men, Joe gave me a present, a collection of old Arabic poetry called the Book of Songs. It's a very old, very rare gift, probably the only one of its kind in the red or the blue.
He opened the book on the table and flipped through it until he came to a photograph slipped between the pages. He handed it first to Joe, who whistled in disbelief at the sight of it. Then he showed it to Surratt.
Be kind, he said. And to tell us you still see some resemblance.
Surratt looked at the old photograph. It was of two lanky young men, one shirtless, the other wearing a uniform of brown camouflage, standing in a desert encampment. A little nameplate was stitched to the uniform's shirt. It read, Joe. The two men looked to be in their late teens, about the same age as Surratt's brother. They were smiling and had their arms around each other's shoulders. The shirtless one was leaning on the butt of his rifle. The other one carried no weapon.
How long ago was this?
She asked.
Must have been 21 or 22, said Gaines. Around the time they sent us over there for the third time, right before the fifth spring.
Joe leaned close to Surratt. He looked at the photograph again.
That's right, he said. I remember. I remember when it was still your guns and our blood.
For a moment, Surratt thought she saw Gaines wince. He took the photograph from her and placed it back between the pages of his book and put the book back on the shelf. Then he sat beside Surratt.
A few weeks ago, we spoke about what you think you might want to do one day, when you're older, when you leave this place, he said. Remember?
Sure,
Surratt replied.
Well,
that's why I wanted to introduce you to my friend Joe.
Because when you settle on what you want to do for yourself, what you want to do for your people, Joe might be able to help you. I know you said you might want to go to Atlanta one day and work for the Free Southern State, but you might change your mind. And then you might find that you need things, things that are hard to obtain, things even I can't procure for you. But Joe might be able to help you. So I want you and him to be friends. And I want you to keep your friendship a secret, because there are lots of people who would want to hurt him if they found out he was helping Southerners. Do you understand?
All right,
Surratt said, even as she wondered what kind of help Joe might provide.
I won't tell.
I'm happy to have met you, Surratt, said Joe. I hope we'll be able to assist each other one day.
She stayed with the two men until it was almost dawn, listening to them reminisce about the old war during which they first met. Much of the world they talked about was long gone, the old dynamics of power now inverted. But she enjoyed listening to it. They talked about the years they spent in the part of the Bouazizi Empire, once called the Arabian Peninsula, a place whose desert heart, once home to glittering, oil-funded kingdoms, was now too hot for human habitation. Surratt knew from her geography and politics textbooks that these parched sandscapes were now lined with wave after wave of solar panels, blinding amber nets that caught the energy needed to feed and finance the empire. But the old men swore there had been cities, entire countries even, in these places. Millions once lived here, they said, before the temperatures soared and the oil ran out. In the early morning, Joe said goodbye and left the camp. Gaines and Surratt were alone together in the office.
There's nothing quite as tedious as old farts droning on about the days of their youth, is there? Said Gaines.
You were generous to indulge us.
That's all right, said Surratt.
Every grown-up in this place talks all day about what it was like when they were young.
At least your stories happen someplace far away.